This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our producer, Justine Paradise, is a relatively recent New Hampshire resident.
Yeah, I just moved here a few months ago. And when I got here, I put up that big, you know, those big I moved posts on Facebook. I did that big announcement.
Seen them.
Yep, yep. And I asked my friends to give me recommendations, just connect me to their people up here, you know, tell me where to eat, whatever. It's what you do when you cross state lines. And actually, my former high school advisor reached out and told me there was someone I had to talk to, Kiani Antigua and Kesely Montas. He goes by Casey. So they're both writers, both published and acclaimed, but they're also married.
Now, that's something that has always struck me as kind of challenging. You know, there's so many ways that living with a partner in the same field, sharing your career, could be pretty tough. And maybe especially in a creative field like, you know, writing or painting, because it is so personal and not always lucrative.
Yeah, I felt the same way. There are some famous examples of artistic couples that have done it, but it's kind of hard to think of a happy one.
Yeah, I think of F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda Fitzgerald, pretty competitive and, you know, probably often drunk.
Yeah, famously unhappy.
George O'Keefe and Alfred Stieglitz, passionate, inspired each other in their work, but they lived apart for many, many years.
Yeah, then I also think of Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. They were on again, off again. They were married and then divorced and then got married again. The one happy couple that maybe I can think of is Joan Didion and John Donne. And they were first readers for each other. They just shared everything. But in her memoir, she did say that some people thought they were too dependent. And maybe that kind of relationship would be too much for some people. So it's tough.
Well, that one certainly lasted. But for those relationships that do function on many levels, that are both creative and romantic, for the ones that actually do work well, the question is how?
Yeah, I was really curious. So I followed up on my former high school advisor's suggestion and spent a Sunday afternoon with Kiani Antigua and Casey Montas at their home in Lebanon.
The sound of sweetness.
I hope you're not listening to this hungry, because when I went to Kiani and Casey's house, we had fried plantains.
So what is the name of this dish?
Just, ¿cómo se dice? Pollo guisado.
Stewed chicken.
Stewed chicken with mushrooms.
This is kind of like a Dominican staple. So white rice, red beans, stewed chicken, and some green salad, and maybe a side of sweet plantains or tostones.
This was actually kind of an exciting moment because they'd found ripe plantains in Lebanon, New Hampshire, which they told me is a first. Usually by the time they get this far north, the plantains are too far gone, and they have to mash them up and make tostones instead. Casey and Kiani both have day jobs. Kiani is an adjunct professor at Dartmouth, and Casey works in safety and security there. But they are both published, prize-winning writers.
But I will say she's more of a short story writer. And
you're more of a poet.
And perhaps I'm more of a poet.
Kiani and Casey were both born in the Dominican Republic. She grew up in the north, he in the south. They each moved to New York City, learning English for the first time as 16 and 17-year-olds. And they both became writers as young people. Casey is a 9-year-old, watching the way his father loved to read.
He's always has a book in his hands.
And later finding a mentor in the poet Jose Coser. For Kiani, she started to write after taking a literature course in college and falling in love with writers like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Borges, and especially a story by Julio Cortázar.
I just couldn't believe it was possible to write so much in such a small space.
After being encouraged by their mentors, they both kept writing, even as they started other jobs. Casey started his career in security, and Kiani worked at a supermarket, Payless Shoe Source, a bank, and finally she began teaching.
So how did you get up here?
It's all his fault. It's all his fault.
Casey had been living in New York for almost a decade, working in safety and security at NYU. The job was intense, and it was hard to find the space to write.
Emerjo desde el centro, detrás de dos portales. A ambos lados, sendos pilares. Avanzan dos que emergen desde sus centros que salen. You sort of become part of the machinery, the gears that make the city move. Desde el gusano. A mi centro yo, desde sus centros, desde mi centro a sus centros ellos, cruzo desde el centro, emerjo, estrujado. I sought refuge in the subway because I knew that I will get to the office in 20 minutes or in 2 hours. It was out of my control. So I did a lot of my reading and a lot of my writing in the subway.
But he'd had enough. So when the job in safety and security at Dartmouth College opened up, he applied, got the position, and moved to Lebanon. He loved the landscape and the quiet, but missed his friends and his community of writers. So he thought, why not get them to come up to New Hampshire? When he organized a weekend, a mutual friend invited Kiani.
The reason why I came is because they told me there was a pool here. Okay? It wasn't all about poetry.
Did you say there was a pool?
No, no. It was my friend who tried to get her. Like, she goes, is there a pool there? I was like, sure. Like, you mean, if that's what you need, we'll make it happen.
We have it.
They got there late, after midnight.
So
I can summarize that. We got here, we were drunk. Okay. There were about around 8 of us. I was the only woman. And we were sitting at this very table, and Casey got a chair and sat really, 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 really close to me. And everybody else was like, okay, what's going on?
Casey cooked a big meal, and then they sat around reading each other's poetry until the wee hours of the morning.
Sounds like your house was like a scene, you know, a literary scene or something.
Yeah.
Yes. It was a good encounter. It was a good encounter. What can I say?
It was a magical weekend, I think.
Kiani was living in New Jersey, but not long after, they met up again, and the rest is history. Now they have a daughter, Mia. She's in first grade, and she's also a writer.
Your comic book?
Yeah, I see. It's called The Secrets of Adventure. Once upon a time, there were three explorers called Lily, Bob, and
Before
Tom.
I met him, I wanted to meet somebody like him. Of course, it's like somebody that understands what I'm doing, that understands this passion. If I say I am writing, you know, he will leave me alone. But then we got Mia.
And which I do leave you alone.
You do leave me alone.
It's not that.
No, but then other things come up. I think we fight more over writing than everything else in our lives.
I think it's also because we have very, very different approaches. I don't want to speak for her, but from my perspective, I think she's impulsive.
Very.
So there you go. And me, on the other hand, I am too slow for her.
Very.
I like to
He's
let
very
things
methodical.
Settle. I am very methodical. I like to let things settle, look them over.
Pragmatic.
I don't like rushing things at all.
We are super critical of each other, more than we are with other people. And this is something that we have learned with time and experience. We criticize each other more, but we take it more seriously, and it hurts more.
But I think that's also part because whether we want it or not, I think we perceive each other as part of one another. So it is like, if it is my work, somehow she's reflected in it.
I have to say, yes, it's upsetting sometimes, but I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't take it any other way. I wouldn't want somebody next to me just saying, this is pretty, oh my God, this is so beautiful. Or somebody not even knowing what I'm talking about. So, no, I enjoy our fights. But forget that, okay?
Do you write every day?
No, not at all. He does. I let it happen. I don't look for it, but I do take advantage when it comes. Mm-hmm. And it comes quite often.
Does that mean, like, you know, when you feel it, you're like, all right, I'm up until 1 a.m, I'm up until this is over.
Or I wake up at 3 a.m, and with lights on or off, I don't care, I get up and I write. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I do write every day. I keep a journal. The way that I see it is like a musician, they have to practice every day. Is their craft. To me, writing, and I write in Spanish, so I keep a journal and I write in Spanish. It's like, you see up there, and I have another.
Casey points to the bookshelf that takes up an entire wall of the room. It's floor-to-ceiling books, with volumes in Spanish and in English, some stacked on the floor. And on the top shelf, there's a row of tall black journals, all numbered, 23, 24, 25.
I have 25 books like that. Every morning is sort of the first conscious act that I do every day, which is to write.
Is that before coffee, or...?
With coffee, during coffee.
Despite their different approaches and perspectives on writing, they have worked together. Casey sometimes translates Kiani's children's books into English, for instance. And the fact that they both write in Spanish and in English They say they serve as dictionaries for each other, always checking words. Is this right? Is this right? But this condition of being bilingual, bicultural, this is something that Casey has written a lot about. He calls it transtierro.
Transtierro is what I call a condition for those of us who are either mentally, emotionally, or physically connected to two lands, two systems, a present and a past, two languages, who have built roots in both places and who have to live navigated between the here and the there, the aquí y the allá. We have to be more Americans than the Americans, and we have to be more Dominicans than the Dominicans, and we have to know about George Washington and have to know about Juan Pablo Duarte. And
you feel like you're tested all the time?
Tested all the time, and you have to prove all the time that you are, that you master both, and yet you are not fully either one.
Meanwhile, Kiani has lately been focusing her work on the life of women.
Mujer, esta casa se quema muy lento. No importa cuántas páginas corran siniestras, cuántos personajes se me inserten en la psiquis y en la pluma, cuántos mundos las musas me anticipen y universos mis dedos inventen. Siempre surgen, subyugantes, la herencia, la polis, que el niño, que cuando el otro, que el polvo, los calderos, el trapo, el marido cama desgane, las arrugas en las caras y en las camisas, las citas, citas.
This was, I think, the first one I wrote about this topic, and it keeps surprising me.
Y las vidas. Pero no importa cuán poeta sea, el lecho de mis uñas siempre termina oliendo a ajo majado y a cebollas. No importa cuánta benzina rocíe, esta casa se quema lento, muy lento.
Being a mom, being a homemaker, being the cook, being the professor, being the translator, being the teacher at the library, it's just amazing all the things that you have to do, not that you want to do, when you are in the position that I am, when you're a woman and you have roles.
She's writing on this theme and is just exploring the idea of putting together an anthology of Dominican women writers. And Casey is enjoying translation, an art in its own right, and he's hoping to translate a book of Donald Hall's poetry next.
I just wonder what it feels like to sort of be in this faraway place for both of you, to be in the mountains and know that there's this world out there that you're interacting with, but it's so far away. Like, what is that like?
To live in this bubble? When I moved here, I remember telling my friend, I am so bored. What am I going to do? And she said, oh, Kiani, you're not bored. You're in peace. In my case, this absolutely beautiful environment has influenced my work, my writing. For example, I have a story called El Canto de la Lechuza, The Owl's Song. And I mean, come on, would I have ever written that in the Dominican Republic or in New York City? And I mean, you've been here for the time that you've been here. Have you heard anything?
Yeah, so quiet out here. Yeah.
So quiet and so peaceful.
I would love to share with you a sound that I love up here, which is the little brook that runs in the backyard. And right now, it is roaring.
We talk for a long time. And when we finally get up from the table, they hand me a pair of mud boots. And all of us, me, Casey, Kiani, and Mia, tromp out to the woods in the backyard.
My feet would get all wet.
By the time we get to the brook, our boots are full of snow. And Casey's right. The brook is roaring with the spring melt, and it is so loud and so quiet at once.
Producer Justine Paradise there with Casey Montas, Kiani Antigua, and their daughter Mia at home in Lebanon, New Hampshire. If you'd like to hear more of their poetry in Spanish and in English, visit wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, the strange relationship between the Emmy Award-winning show The West Wing and town designations in New Hampshire. That's coming up on our Only in New Hampshire series. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire is known for its charming small towns, but some places are really, really small. We got a question to our Only in New Hampshire series about this very thing.
Hi, my name is Sam McClough, and my question for Only in NH is, what is the smallest hamlet in the state by population?
Our executive producer, Erica Janik, is here to tell us the answer. So, Erica, what is the smallest hamlet in New Hampshire?
Hart's Location.
That's it?
Yeah. And no.
What does that mean?
The problem here is actually the word hamlet. I checked with Ken Gallagher at the New Hampshire Office of Strategic Initiatives to see if hamlet actually has a legal meaning in New Hampshire.
And?
No. And classifying places is really complicated. There are towns, cities, unincorporated places such as townships or grants, and then those villages that are sometimes within towns. Now, the Census Bureau classifies towns and townships as minor civil divisions. They also have something called the Census Designated Place, which is a concentration of people but not a legal boundary. So based on this, the smallest place that the census tracks in New Hampshire is Blodgett Landing, population 101.
That is complicated. And then there's probably the smallest town by area, correct?
Right. And that's Union, which is 0.3 square miles. But they actually pack 204 people on that piece of land. Pack being a relative term here.
So depending on how you slice this, the smallest hamlet is Hart's Location, Blodgett Landing, and Union. Maybe I should have just stuck with your original answer.
Right. And also, for the sake of playing this West Wing clip, we'll stick with Hart's Location, called Hartsfield's Landing, in this episode. Now, it made the show because Hart's Location, along with another small place, Dixville Notch, gets a lot of national attention every 4 years for casting the first votes in the New Hampshire primary. You might remember that the president on the show is from New Hampshire, and in this clip, you'll hear Press Secretary C.J. Craig and Deputy Chief of Staff Josh Lyman discussing the vote in this tiny New Hampshire town.
Here's our West Wing bonus.
Should be all West Wing bonus.
45 minutes till Hartsfield's landing.
We're working the room.
Good.
It is absurd that 42 people have this kind of power.
I think it's nice.
Do you?
I think it's democracy at its purest. They all gather at once.
At a gas station.
It's not a gas station. It's nice. There's a registrar of voters. The names are called in alphabetical order. They put a folded piece of paper into a box. See, this is the difference between you and me.
You're a sap?
Those 42 people are teaching us something about ourselves, that freedom is the glory of God, that democracy is its birthright, and that our vote matters.
You getting the pizza? Or?
Yeah, I should call him.
Word of Mouth's executive producer, Erica Janik, reporting for our Only in New Hampshire series. And if you have questions about New Hampshire, whether you're curious about the real story behind that weird plaque in the center of town, or is it Kankamangus or Kankamagus, we would love to hear from you. You can submit your question at wordofmouthradio.org, send an email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org, or leave us a voicemail at 603-513-7796. April 11th is Yom HaShoah, also known as Holocaust Remembrance Day. But while many people work to keep the memory of the Holocaust alive through education, events, and museum exhibitions, Bodo and Margaret Schrader are on a more personal journey, a kind of detective story trying to piece together a childhood and a family shattered by the Nazi persecution of Jews, and to reconcile Bodo's traumatic memories with a paper trail that doesn't always line up. We spoke with Bodo and Margaret back in November.
November 11th, I will become 38 twice. I refuse to enunciate those other numbers.
We'll get a cake.
Sure. Bodo Schrader's what people call a character. Impish grin, yellowed mustache, a pack of Marlboros in his shirt pocket.
Oh, I'm checking her pulse.
Oh, she's a live one.
He came to the U.S. from Germany when he was just a kid, lived in Chicago, Massachusetts, later in Wisconsin, and eventually, he and his daughter Margaret landed in Manchester, New Hampshire. Just don't ask when.
How long have you lived in Manchester?
We came here in, I think, 79. We've been here 30 years, 40 years.
We came in the 80s, Daddy.
80s?
Yeah.
Memory is a sore point for Bodo and Margot. It's not just keeping track of all the moves as Bodo's gotten older, but because Bodo is a Holocaust survivor.
Okay, psychologically, if we injure ourselves or we don't like the situation we're in, a human being's nature is to shut it down. And I believe a part of what happened with me was I just kind of shut it down.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott. Next week, people across the world will gather to remember Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass, when public violence against Jews and Jewish establishments erupted in Germany in 1938. But while many work to keep the memory of the Holocaust alive through education and events and museum exhibitions, Bodo and Margot are on a more personal journey, a detective story trying to piece together a childhood and family shattered by the Nazi persecution of Jews, and to reconcile Bodo's traumatic memories with a paper trail that doesn't always line up.
When my mother was taken, I was a year and a half, maybe two, okay, and they just left me in the apartment, basically left me there to die. Mm. And what really ticks me off is I wasn't even worth a bullet.
I met with Bodo and Margot in a small conference room at the Jewish Federation of New Hampshire. Bodo sipped a cup of black coffee. Margot sat with her hands resting on the edge of a stuffed manila folder. They both work in Manchester. Margot is a mental health worker. Bodo manages a rooming house on Pine Street, a job he's held for more than two decades. But his story starts in Magdeburg, Germany, where he was the youngest of five children born to Karl and Margot Schrader.
When you were growing up, did you hear much of that story of your dad's history?
Not really. He told me little bits and pieces of what he remembered. I always knew that my grandmother had died in Auschwitz and that I was named after her and that my name was really important because of that.
Your
kid hates, it's Margot. Margot in a world of Margots because New Hampshire is all French, so.
The broad details have been easy enough to recover, though astounding in their cruelty. In 1938, German authorities decreed that all Jews identify their heritage. Men were to add Israel to their given names. Women were required to add Sarah. Bodo's mother refused and was arrested several times. In 1942, the Gestapo came to their apartment and carted her off to Auschwitz. Bodo and his siblings were put into an orphanage. Their father, Karl, was a Gentile, a member of the Apostolic Church, and a Nazi soldier.
So your grandfather was a German soldier in the Nazi army married to a Jewish woman?
Yes.
And he was ordered to divorce her, and he refused.
My grandmother died in Auschwitz in 1943. They said the reason was pneumonia, but that's just what it said in the Auschwitz death book. A whole bunch of stuff was sent back to my grandfather, none of it was hers. It was just a bunch of random belongings.
For his defiance, Karl was sent to what Bodo and his daughter now believe was a labor camp. Margot was still nursing Bodo when she was taken away, so memories of his parents were long buried by the time he arrived in the U.S. Bodo tried for decades to find out about his family and his past. Now he has access to something he never had growing up, Google.
Just on a whim, I typed in Margot Schrader, and this picture came up of her and everything in German.
Have that picture. That's the first picture my father ever saw.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And you'll notice that she's got the Schrader nose.
When did you start doing all of this digging?
2 years now.
Yeah.
This woman has come up with God knows what.
Yeah.
She's a little magician when it comes to this research.
Since then, Margot's uncovered more photos, inventories, affidavits, and other official documentation. Still, understanding how a baby made his way from an orphanage to a concentration camp to the United States is painstaking and painful work. After Bodo's father, Karl Schrader, was released from the labor camp, he collected his children from the orphanage where they'd been left, except for Bodo, who for some reason was left behind.
as parents, we make difficult decisions sometimes, and that was one of the decisions he made, was to leave my dad there. He felt that it was a better place for him. So he ended up taking the other children back to Magdeburg, Germany, with him.
Theresienstadt was like a holding pen for Jews being sent to concentration camps in other parts of the Reich. It was also an elaborate propaganda tool for the Nazis. They used it to convince foreign delegations and the International Red Cross that Germany treated its prisoners of war with dignity. They opened up shops and a cafe and a pavilion for musical performances. It was all a sham, of course. Roughly 33,000 prisoners died in Theresienstadt. Many more were deported from there to other death camps across Europe. Theresienstadt was liberated in May of 1945, and among the prisoners discovered there, 4-year-old Bodo Schrader.
We have an affidavit from a woman named Elsa Fischer, who was also in Theresienstadt, and she actually found him in a room by himself, uncared for, and he had a sign around his name that said his name was Bodo Schrader. Yeah, and that's how? I don't know.
That was the first recollection. Margaret dug up a picture of Elsa. She showed me the picture and I said, Mutti.
What happened after being liberated from the camp is the murkiest part of Bodo's story. And while Margaret's research did stir up some long-faded memories for Bodo, memory is slippery. Both time and trauma alter our recollections of the past. And so Margaret has taken on an unusual role as a sort of fact checker for her father's childhood experiences.
I was in Israel. I had to come back to this country, to Germany.
After Theresienstadt, Bodo spent some time in Munich with Elsa, or Mutti's family, but was eventually sent to an orphanage in the United States. In Bodo's version of the events, there's a plane crash, lost records, and being sent for a time to Israel and then back to Berlin. It's a narrative that Margaret gently puts aside.
To the United States.
Yeah.
So this is one of these memories that Dad has that I haven't been able to find proof of yet. So
well,
this is...
Because of the fact that Mia went to Ellis Island, my name is there.
Yeah, well, but that's the thing is, though, is that the date that you left Munich and the date that you arrived on Ellis Island is too close together for any of the other stuff to happen.
Right.
And the liberation, and it, so it's just, it's hard. I haven't been...
What is documented is that Bodo's life did not get much easier. He was adopted by a Jewish family in Chicago, but when he was just a preteen, Margot says the family set Bodo's adoption aside.
What do you mean your adoption was set aside?
Yeah, my father's adoption was set aside.
52.
Yeah, 52, because they found out that Carl Schrader was alive and in Germany, and he wasn't Jewish.
For Bodo, it was another rejection. He was angry and acted out, says he constantly got into fights. After again being abandoned, he had serious trust issues. His short-lived adoptive parents sent Bodo to the Windsor Mountain School in Lenox, Massachusetts. It was run by a German woman, said to be one of Europe's first female doctors and a student of Sigmund Freud, Dr. Gertrude Bondy.
Scary woman. First time I met her, she pegged me in 15 minutes.
Pegged you as what?
Who I was and what my problems were, and kind of told me that if I didn't straighten up, she was going to hurt me. And I believed her.
So you learned to be scrappy. You were a survivor.
To this day, I'm that way, but I mean, what else is new?
The injuries of Bodo's past lay coiled and ready to strike just below the surface. But there's one significant part of his legacy that Bodo has not been able to access, something he wasn't old enough to own when he was in Germany, the very reason for his horrifying treatment, his faith.
I still have a hard time going to a synagogue.
Why?
I don't know. I have no idea whatsoever. I've gone. I know functionally what everything is, the Torah and you know, but I am Jewish. I do not deny the fact that I am Jewish. I'm actually proud of it. you know, but there's still residuals from all the time that I was in the various locations that don't let me feel comfortable.
Belonging and history are complicated concepts for Margaret, too. She was astonished to discover previously unknown relatives while piecing together her father's story. A handful of descendants of Bodo's father, Carl Schrader, were still living in Magdeburg, Germany. One of them, a niece, speaks English. And no surprise, they're all on Facebook.
I would love to go.
You haven't been back?
No. Financially, I am incapable of doing that at this point. If the paperwork that she's working on comes to fruition, we should have the money to be able to go back to Germany.
Margaret became determined to get her father to Germany to meet them. That's how she discovered something called the Claims Conference, a pool of funds paid out by the German government to compensate victims of the Holocaust. The application is no joke. So for help, Margaret reached out to a community she and her father had never felt a part of, the Jewish community. Melanie Zalman McDonald, executive director of the Jewish Federation of New Hampshire, responded, and she's been helping the Schraders through the emotionally taxing application process for reparations.
I mean, it's one thing to fill in the blank with your name, you know, or your date of birth, but to, fill in the blank, type of persecution, you know, forced resettlement, separation from family, and to have all of your attachments to your application be things like birth certificates and death certificates and affidavits.
I have a page from the Auschwitz death book that has my grandmother's name on it. I have the manifest that shows my father traveling from Munich to the U.S. His name is there. His name is in the book for Therenstadt survivors. It's just so surreal.
The experience of putting the family story out there is a scary and exhilarating one for Margaret. No matter what happens with the claims conference or the GoFundMe page she set up to help raise money to get them to Germany, Margaret says all her research has helped her better understand her dad. And for Bodo, to get some perspective on his past.
In all the time that I have been on this earth, there's no reason why I should have survived whatsoever. None whatsoever. But for the fact that there were good people who stepped in in a very important way, at just the right time. It's people like Melanie, people like Dr. Bondi, Elsa, who saved my life, basically. All of these people, without them, I wouldn't be here today.
Bodo, I really want to thank you for sharing your story today.
It's an honor. If time don't run out, I'll be able to get to Germany.
Will you send us a postcard from Germany?
Of course. She does the writing, so ask her.
Since this segment first aired in November, we caught up with Margaret and asked her how things were going. She says that the application was delayed, and she's hoping to send it out in the next week or so. And the trip is, as of yet, unplanned. Margaret and Bodo have been speaking, though, and spending a lot more time with the Jewish community in New Hampshire. They will be speaking on April 11th as part of Holocaust Remembrance Day at Temple Beth Abraham in Nashua, and that event is open to the public. There are details at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next on Word of Mouth, small town, big oil. Three local women take on the richest man in the world and win. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
This is NBC Nightly News, Wednesday, October 17th.
New Hampshire might have had an oil refinery on its seacoast today. It was the fall of 1973, and there was an oil crisis. OPEC retaliated against American support for Israel in its war with Syria.
They will reduce oil production by 5% a month until the Israelis withdraw from occupied territories. If the Arab countries keep that pledge...
Energy prices soared. Long lines formed at American gas stations. The embargo set off a global economic crisis and an opportunity for shipping magnate Aristotle Onassis, then one of the richest men in the world and famous for marrying the widowed Jacqueline Kennedy. Onassis proposed building the world's largest oil refinery on New Hampshire's slender coast. Onassis's people expected a slam dunk. They did not bargain for an organized resistance movement led primarily by three formidable women. I spoke with author David Moore, who wrote about how these three women kept Durham Point from becoming a colossal industrial site in a book called Small Town, Big Oil, and asked him what exactly were the plans for the refinery on the New Hampshire seacoast.
Aristotle Onassis had wanted to have a refinery for a long time. After his effort to establish a refinery in Greece had fallen through for various reasons, and he had been looking actually in Nova Scotia at that point. But Peter Boris, who is a failed GOP Senate candidate in New Hampshire, was friends with Constantine Gratzos. Constantine Gratzos was Aristotle Onassis's right-hand man. So Boris goes to Gratzos and says, hey, our governor wants an oil refinery. You wanted an oil refinery. You know, maybe we could work something out. So Onassis's man, Gratzos, comes and talks with the governor, and he gets reassurance that everything is going to be okay and that they'll actually be able to get this refinery. And they decided to locate it at Durham Point for the following reason. First of all, they wanted to unload oil from the shipping tankers, and that could be done from the Isles of Shoals, about 9 miles off the coast. They would ship it underwater in these great big pipes to the town of Rye, which was the closest land point. And then they would ship it overground in pipes over to Durham Point, which was the closest area where they could find some 3,000 acres and relatively undeveloped land. So without much investigation into the nature of the town or the nature of state politics or into the nature of the environment, they decided that that's what they were going to do. So when they first met with the town, they had done none of the research that was necessary to figure out whether they would have the amount of water they needed, whether the land was appropriate for it, how they could protect the environment, and so on. And so therefore, they came across as pretty naive.
When did residents first learn of Onassis's company, which is Olympic Oil, and its plans to site a refinery here?
Well, the first time there was any clear indication was when Public Occurrences, a local newspaper that had started only a couple months earlier, announced that the purchase of some several thousand acres or a couple thousand acres of land options on Durham Point in Durham might be related to the governor's desire to locate a refinery in the state.
Residents were getting approached by people often pulling up in black sedans, offering to buy their property. One of them, Nancy Sandberg, a Durham Point resident, decided to tape record the next conversation with this gentleman, Peter Boras. Why were they so suspicious?
Well, the reason they were suspicious is that there appeared to be a couple of men, Peter Boras and George Papademos, who were going around in the neighborhood saying that they wanted to buy up land, and they needed it for various reasons. One person said, I just want it for myself. And they said, well, if you want it for yourself, you know, why do you need, you know, 40 acres or 50 acres? I said, oh, I might have some other people. I said, another person said they wanted it for a game preserve. Someone else said they absolutely was not going to be for any kind of development. But there were so many offers that Nancy Sandberg, after being approached herself, she realized that this really sounded suspicious. So she got together with one of the local residents and asked him if he would hold a neighborhood meeting, which they did. And they all shared their stories. And they said, something is really going on here. And it was at that point that they decided where they would organize. But they didn't know what they were going to organize against. So finally they came up with a term called Save Our Shores, or SOS. And Nancy was declared president.
Phyllis Bennett, she and her husband Steve were running the newspaper Public Occurrences that picked up on this story very, very early. But this sets off this breathless pace, and the unfolding of the fight goes on throughout your book. But it's also the story of these three women, Nancy Sandberg, Phyllis Bennett, and also Dudley Dudley. Were they fighting for the same reasons, different reasons?
Initially, none of the three knew each other. Phyllis Bennett, it was her husband initially, Steve, who was listed on the masthead. Her mission was to provide information to the town that was needed. That was their goal. Dudley Dudley, on the other hand, was a local representative. And so her job as the sole Democrat, and of course the only woman from Durham and one of few women in the state legislature, was to try to persuade GOP leadership that this is not something that should be done. And so Dudley Dudley was at the state level as a representative trying to prevent the town from being overridden by the state. Phyllis Bennett was providing the information through the newspaper, and Nancy Sandberg was trying to organize the town. Nancy did call up Dudley shortly after the news broke and asked Dudley to come and speak before SOS. And later, they all became very close friends. But at the time, they each were following their own job, so to speak, and trying to prevent the installation of a large, which would have been the largest refinery in the world at that time.
My guest is David Moore. He's written a book, several books, but most recently, Small Town, Big Oil. This is the story of three women who took on the richest man in the world, Aristotle Onassis at the time, and William Loeb and Meldrum Thompson here in New Hampshire in 1973, which someone describes as not a David and Goliath story, but David versus Goliath and his two friends. So let's talk about Onassis's main proponents, Meldrum Thompson and William Loeb. First, Loeb, remind us, like, what kind of power did he wield here in New Hampshire in 1973?
The political culture in New Hampshire at the time was really one that was dominated by William Loeb, and his outright bullying was really detrimental to any kind of reasonable discussion. By 1973, William Loeb had been an editor or had been publisher of the only statewide newspaper, the Manchester Union Leader, for a couple of decades, and he had been trying to get really control the politics in the state. The other person was Governor Meldrum Thompson. Thompson was ultra-conservative. He proposed that that our National Guard be armed with nuclear weapons. Somebody went by, drove by, and gave him the finger, and so he had that person arrested. It was just a real, very different environment once Meldrum Thompson got into office. But he was very much for the refinery. He kept promising that he would not override home rule, that if the town said they didn't want it, he would go along with it. But in the end, he supported a number of Republican leaders who were bent on amending a bill that would give the state the power to site a refinery despite what the local town might want. So there was this hypocrisy that was going on at the same time.
So there were these three powerful men fighting against this citizenry, led by these three women. And of course, there were a lot more people involved. But it does come down to a sort of big guys versus little women. At least that's the way that William Loeb presented them. Little ladies beating their small breasts. Where did gender play into this fight?
Gender was an important factor. From Dudley's point of view, it was particularly difficult. She got all sorts of hate calls and hate mail, and the union leader itself went after her, and they constantly referred to as Mrs. Thomas Dudley rather than as Representative Dudley Dudley. Talked about her as the housewife, constantly trying to demean. And, of course, in the legislature, she got a lot of criticisms, essentially saying that as a woman she didn't really know what she was talking about, but came through in, you know, in sterling fashion and really showed, you know, how strong a woman she was.
Was this classic NIMBYism? These women just, they didn't want their backyard to look like, as they said, northern New Jersey.
Yes, it was. And as far as it conceptually goes, to say not in my backyard but someplace else, that is always a problem because you say, well, why should we protect your area? What Dudley was trying to show to many of the representatives that the whole area along Great Bay was a fragile ecosystem, a combination of freshwater and seawater with its own estuary, and it had a very profound impact upon the habitat for wild animals and birds. So they were trying to argue that there are better places to put an oil refinery. But still, you couldn't help but recognize that to some extent they didn't want it in their area, and that if other areas wanted it, they could have it, but certainly not in the Great Bay Area.
Well, let's get into that, because here we have first-term representative from Durham, Dudley Dudley. You mentioned first Democrat in 50 years, first female Democrat. She decided to use this tactic of home rule, which was a great risk. Now, by the way, the legislature was not in session. They had to call a special session in order for this to be even brought forward. Tell us a little bit more about this concept of home rule and how it could really work both ways.
Well, there's a strong tradition of home rule in New Hampshire that says essentially the towns and the cities have the authority to govern as much as they can without interference from the state. So here was it was really an environmental issue, this large refinery coming into a very fragile ecosystem. But Dudley knew that the environmental argument probably wouldn't be very persuasive because of the energy crisis and because of the governor's own preference for getting this oil refinery. So therefore, she decided that the major argument should be home rule. And ultimately, that's what was crucial.
Now, by some polls, 65% of New Hampshire residents wanted this. What kind of case were Olympic Oil supporters making in order to sell this to the citizens of New Hampshire and of Durham?
Well, there were these promises by Olympic, promises they would bring more jobs. It would bring a very big tax rebate to the town so that their taxes would go down because the oil refinery would be paying so much taxes. There would be more distribution of gasoline and of heating oil. Well, all those three promises turned out to be false. The taxable part of the oil refinery would have been very small part of the overall operation. The distribution of heating oil and of gasoline is done by the federal government on a regional level. In New Jersey, for example, it was pointed out, which has a lot of oil refineries, they had long lines of people waiting for gas, just as we did here in New England. And then there was the question of jobs. Turns out there might have been an increase of maybe 1,000 jobs, not 15,000 as was promised. So these were the promises that were made. And, of course, the governor supported it and the statewide daily newspaper did. And so that was probably why a Boston Globe poll showed that a clear majority of citizens in the state said that they would support an oil refinery into the state. But what the poll didn't do would say, would you support an oil refinery being located in a city or town that does not want it? Had they asked that question, they would have found a majority of people opposed. And so ultimately, when the vote came down to the final decision by the House, they voted against it by a significant majority.
David Moore, thank you so much for telling us this story.
Thank you very much, Virginia. I appreciate it.
David Moore, he's author of several books on politics in New Hampshire and beyond. He's senior fellow at the Carsey School for Public Policy at UNH. He's going to be reading from his new book, which is Small Town, Big Oil, at Water Street Books in Exeter on April 24th and at Annie's Bookstop in Worcester, Mass. On April 29th. We'll have details at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. That is it this week for Word of Mouth. Special thanks to Marilyn Barrett for this episode, which was produced by Justine Paradise, with Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, and our executive producer, Erica Janik. Maureen McMurray is director of The Plums in the Icebox. So sweet and so cold. Music in this episode from Steve Combs, Ikimashu Aoi, Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, and Ari De Niro. You can find us online at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.